change is almost inevitable.
On that note, we'll come to the end of this debate show. Let me thank our guests. We had former Deputy Mayor of London, Lee Jasper, who joined us from London, also British political activist and writer Jackie Walker, who joined us out of Kent with their insight and comments.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalul ladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
Vietlines, a senior Iranian source, tells Press TV that Tehran won't accept a gradual removal of U.S. sanctions or any talks with Washington before all sanctions are lifted. Palestinians have slammed as provocative the recent Israeli settlers' incursion into Al-Aqsa Mosque. We'll have a report from Ramallah. Also coming up, a homicide investigator gives a devastating testimony on the fifth day of the trial of a former U.S. officer charged with the murder of unarmed African-American George Floyd. An informed source has told Press TV that the United States has no option but to remove all anti-Iran sanctions. The source says that is the only way forward to persuade Tehran to hold back the rollback of its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal.
Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, held virtual talks on Friday to discuss the fate of the agreement. During the meeting attended by China, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain, along with Iran, the signatories agreed to hold in-person talks in Vienna on Tuesday. That will be part of the meetings of the Joint Commission of the Nuclear Deal. Later, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed there will be indirect talks with Iran in Vienna.
These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA, and the sanctions relief steps the United States would need to take in order to return to compliance.
But an informed Iranian source told Press TV that Tehran will hold no direct or indirect talks with Washington before it removes all anti-Iranian sanctions.
According to the immutable guidelines set out by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, any outcome of the joint JCPOA commission meeting, which is based on the notion of step-by-step removal of sanctions, is unacceptable. According to the guidelines by the leader, the Islamic Republic will only return to its JCPOA commitments after the removal of all U.S. sanctions and Iran's verification of the move. The Islamic Republic will not hold any mediated or unmediated talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted. just as the U.S. left the 2015 nuclear deal without negotiations and imposed sanctions on Iran, it should now remove all sanctions without talks.
Iran signed into the 2015 nuclear deal and committed itself to limiting its civilian nuclear program in exchange for removal of all nuclear-related sanctions against the country. That was meant to ensure Iran benefits economically from the accord. But those benefits were scarce and fully evaporated after the former U.S. administration withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. Analysts say all Iran is saying is that a once-negotiated deal does not need to be renegotiated.
The deal was the result of negotiations. So the negotiations have already taken place. The deal tells all sides what they're supposed to do. So the Americans know exactly what they're supposed to do. There's nothing to negotiate. If they want the deal to work, they have to implement it. But if they want to take bits and pieces and think that they can gain concessions from Iran, Iran is not going to do that.
Almost 3 months into the Biden administration, Washington is yet to right Donald Trump's wrongs on the nuclear deal. Tehran is clearly seeing through Washington's empty rhetoric and is calling for action. On Friday, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told a virtual meeting on the nuclear deal that the remedial measures Iran took after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal are reversible, but only after the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions and its verification by Tehran.
Israeli settlers have forced their way into occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds flashpoints Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to celebrate a Jewish holiday. Palestinians have condemned the move, calling it provocative. Monica Deal has more.
Israeli settlers have escalated their daily raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds in the last couple of days during their celebrations of one of the Jewish holidays known as Passover. On Thursday alone, hundreds of Israeli settlers raided the holy site under the protection of Israeli forces, according to the Muslim religious authorities, or what's known as the Awqaf, which administrates the compound. Palestinian officials denounced what they described as provocative moves, saying that Israel has simultaneously banned Palestinian worshippers from entering the mosque.
The Israelis are accompanied and protected by soldiers and are allowed to raid the site and desecrate it. The Israeli forces closed the markets and the shops in the old town. A number of Palestinian youths were detained. It was another occupation of the Al-Aqsa complex and the old town, but this time by the settlers along with the soldiers.
Israeli settler groups have called on their supporters to converge on the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in celebration of Passover, which began on March 27 and lasts until April 3. Thousands of Israeli soldiers were deployed across Jerusalem Al-Quds to provide a protection to settlers who toured in groups the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and took photos of several places. Other strict measures have also been taken on Friday to prevent Muslims reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Experts believe the incursions are part of Israel's policy to Judaize the holy site and expel the Palestinians out from the holy city.
The Israeli regime is escalating the situation in Jerusalem Al-Quds. It's only mounting tensions. The Israeli prime minister is facing internal problems and he's looking for a way to survive. He knows settlers will help him to do so. That is why he won't stop their acts. Therefore, the settlers are provided with a good opportunity to desecrate the site and provoke the Palestinians during their holidays.
Since its occupation of the Palestinian lands, Israel has been launching violence to crack down on Palestinians in different ways, especially when it serves Tel Aviv's interests. During the Jewish holidays, Israeli settlers escalate their raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinians say the raids are provocative and pursue the policy of suppression by Israeli regime against the Palestinian people living in the holy city of Al-Quds. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
In other news, Yemen's defense minister warned Saudi Arabia against pushing ahead with its aggression against his country, saying Sana'a is capable of hitting many targets deep inside the kingdom. Mohammed Nasser al-Atifi said Yemen has been expanding its military capacities for launching retaliatory attacks. He said Yemen's growing military power cannot be compared with 6 years ago when the Saudi-led coalition started an onslaught on the impoverished country. Riyadh launched the war in an attempt to reinstate the Saudi-allied former regime. The military campaign, coupled with an all-out blockade, has devastated most of Yemen's infrastructure and led to a massive humanitarian crisis. political commentator Yusuf Mari says Yemeni forces have the upper hand in the conflict with Saudi-led forces and are poised to score more military gains.
So we can sense that the Saudi officials, the Saudi monarchy, they're in a perturbed state. They're getting nervous. They don't know what to do. So they go back, you know, they reach out to the UN and to the US, and, you know, they're having discussions on the situation in Yemen. And Saudi Arabia did not imagine that they would be in this position. They did not think that after 6 years, the Ansarullah movement would be victorious. Ansarullah movement would take over more territory. And the Saudi mercenaries are basically on their last leg in the province of Madib. It's just a matter of a couple of more weeks before the province of Madib falls under Ansarullah control. And if that happens, the scale will tip in the favors of Ansarullah. It's honestly, it's to the point where Ansarullah doesn't even have to engage in negotiations, because if they continue to advance and if they continue to launch a series of attacks on Saudi Arabia, you know, Saudi Arabia is eventually going to put up the white flags, and if that's what it's going to take to get them to stop intervening in Yemen's political affairs, that's what Ansarullah is dedicated to achieving.
Bahrainis have staged rallies to demand the immediate and unconditional release of all prisoners of conscience amid the coronavirus pandemic. Demonstrations took place in the capital, Manama, and 18 other towns and villages across the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. The protesters carried signs reading that political prisoners are facing the threat of COVID-19 in overcrowded cells. Rights activists have also sounded the alarm that the respiratory disease is spreading among prisoners. According to the London-based Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, dozens of COVID cases have been recorded among inmates in Bahrain. Bahrain's public prosecution office has announced that 126 prisoners will be free to serve their terms outside jails under electronic monitoring because of the pandemic. The country has registered some 150,000 infections and over 500 deaths. Elsewhere, four United Nations peacekeepers have been killed in an attack on a camp in northern Mali. The UN mission said 19 others were also wounded in the attack carried out by several heavily armed terrorists on Friday. It said the attackers also suffered heavy losses. Also on Friday, three Malian soldiers were killed in another attack blamed on terrorists. Mali has been mired in violence since 2012, with Al-Qaeda and Daesh-linked groups fighting for the control of central and northern regions. The violence has remained uncontained despite military assistance from the United Nations. Thousands have died in attacks, including about 230 UN peacekeepers. More witnesses have testified on the fifth day of the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former US police officer who killed unarmed African-American George Floyd in Minneapolis last year.
What is your view of that use of force during that time period?
Totally unnecessary.
What do you mean?
Well, first of all, pulling him down to the ground, face down, and putting your knee on the neck for that amount of time is just uncalled for. I saw no reason why the officers felt they were in danger, if that's what they felt.
Richard Zimmerman told the jury that kneeling on a person's neck can kill them. He said officers are responsible for the care of detainees and are trained to provide first aid if they are injured. The senior officer was called to testify whether Chauvin was following his police training correctly. During the arrest of George Floyd last May, Chauvin knelt on the victim's neck for about 9 minutes before he lost consciousness and died. The incident, filmed by bystanders, rocked the United States. It led to widespread protests against police mistreatment of African Americans. Political commentator Barry Grossman says U.S. police suffer no consequences for violating constitutional rights of ordinary people. Here he is.
Frankly, I simply don't see U.S. police departments being at all responsive to what's decided by the judiciary. There's an undue number of former military servicemen and women that end up gravitating to the police. Certainly a lot of racists, and while policing is always a difficult thing, I think it's rather unfortunate that more care isn't taken when it comes to the kind of individual that's recruited for being a domestic policeman in the United States, and of course in setting the protocols that determines what kind of techniques they can use in what situations. Certainly police unions in the United States and state police departments, municipal police departments are completely out of touch with what's decided by the judiciary, and in fact out of touch with what has long been decided by the judiciary when it comes to ordinary people's constitutional rights to be secure against unreasonable police action.
Staying in the United States, where one of the two police officers targeted in a car ramming attack outside the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., has succumbed to his injuries. The second officer was transferred to hospital. The assailant was fatally shot by law enforcement officers when he got out of his vehicle. He was said to have been armed with what appeared to be a knife. Local police said the incident doesn't appear to be terror-related and that there are no ongoing threats. The attack prompted the authorities to put the building under lockdown. The motive behind the attack is not clear yet. The incident comes less than 3 months after supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the Congress building in an attempt to overturn the 2020 election results. Our correspondent in Washington, D.C., White Reed, joined us earlier with the latest on the Capitol attack. Here he is.
A lot of the big details still up in the air. We do have names, of course, of the officer killed in the attack. He's been named as William Evans, apparently an 18-year veteran of the U.S. Capitol Police Force. You're hearing now that the suspect in the alleged killing is a man named Noah Green, 25-year-old man from Indiana. So those are sort of the major details that we are seeing right now. Of course, the police force, which was basically a lockdown sort of situation, that has been alleviated. They brought out riot police and full riot gear, attempting to basically totally shut down the area. That has largely dissipated, although the immediate area around which the attack occurred has been closed off. It's a crime scene currently.
U.S. President Joe Biden has pledged his, quote, unwavering support for Ukraine in the face of Russia's aggression. Biden made the remarks during a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky. This came after Western nations and NATO voiced concern over Russian troop movements near the eastern Donbass region. Earlier, Moscow warned against any deployment of Western troops in Ukraine near Russia's borders. It has also warned that any standoff in the region could begin a potentially dangerous chain of events. The rising tensions follow a series of reported clashes in the eastern Ukraine. The region has seen on and off clashes between Kiev forces and pro-Russian militias.
The West and Russia are on a collision course again over Ukraine. The Kremlin has warned the Western military alliance NATO that any deployment of troops along the Ukrainian border with Russia would deteriorate the situation further. Moscow says it would be forced to take extra measures to ensure its own security if the U.S.-led NATO sends troops in support of Ukraine. That, a day after the Ukrainian president accused Russia of building up troops along the border amid renewed clashes between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian militias. Russia says its military presence on the border is not meant to threaten Ukraine. Moscow's response came after the U.S. warned last week against what it called Russian intimidation and pledged to stand by Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine have had a conflict centered on Crimea and Donbass regions since 2014. Tensions surfaced with Kiev and Moscow recently trading blame for a spike in violence in eastern Ukraine. In a recent meeting, NATO ambassadors condemned what they called Moscow's military buildup near Ukraine. However, the Russia foreign minister says the U.S.-led anti-Russia NATO campaign will ultimately destroy Ukraine.
Judging by the information published by the media, the majority of Ukrainian military forces understands the fatality of any actions leading to a hot conflict. I very much hope that they will not be incited by politicians, who in turn will be incited by the West, led by the United States.
The US and European leaders are losing no time to denounce and threaten Russia citing Ukraine. Tensions have been running high ever since Ukraine's Crimea region re-entered into Russia following a referendum. Since then, NATO has been expanding its Eastern Front. The United States missile systems in Romania and Poland, as well as American soldiers and military hardware in the region, are part of the military alliance game plan. Latvia and Lithuania are among destinations where NATO members have been sending their troops and weaponries. The reason? They lie right along the border with Russia. Apart from military deployments near Russia's borders, the West has imposed several rounds of sanctions against the Kremlin. It seems the continued pressure on Russia could plunge the two sides into another Cold War era and throw them and their allies into yet another vicious arms race.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full in the days gone by. O the most merciful.
In the limelight.
The Guardian published an article about Trump's new official website with the headline, Donald Trump uses new website to rewrite history of his presidency. The Guardian calls out the language Trump's site uses, describing his actions and accomplishments that are listed as being hyperbolic. Beyond omitting a number of his failures and follies, the Trump site also attempts to deflect blame as well. Dear listeners, we have prepared an article for you in this regard written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Trump's new official website attempts to rewrite history and gain online clout. Stay tuned for more. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has launched a new website that promotes himself heavily as a magnificent leader, failing to contextualize that ambitious claim with the numerous scandals, two impeachments, and hundreds of thousands of deaths from coronavirus that occurred under his tenure. Trump's site masks the difficulties he had in office while describing his supposed successes in positive ways. But many observers have noted that the site, viewable at 45office.com, appears to be also a vainglorious attempt at rewriting the history of the past 4 years. The office of Donald J. Trump is committed to preserving the magnificent legacy of the Trump administration while at the same time advancing the America First agenda. The site's main landing page states, hinting that the former Republican will seek to continue influencing the U.S. political scene for some time to come. News media across the web have panned the site as being one-sided and misleading. The Guardian published an article about the website with the headline, Donald Trump uses new website to rewrite history of his presidency. The Guardian calls out the language Trump's site uses, describing his actions and accomplishments that are listed as being hyperbolic. Beyond omitting a number of his failures and follies, the Trump site also attempts to deflect blame as well. For example, while discussing his leadership during the coronavirus pandemic, the site makes it seem as though all responsibility for U.S. deaths rests solely with China. When the coronavirus plague arrived from China, afflicting every nation around the globe, President Trump acted early and decisively. This site claims, disregarding the fact that Trump spent weeks falsely claiming the virus would go away on its own, and subsequently downplayed the seriousness of COVID-19 throughout the remainder of 2020. More than 400,000 Americans died from the virus while Trump was in office. Numerous studies and former health officials that served within his office have contended that his inaction on the pandemic likely led to hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths. The About section for the site, at just under 900 words, reads like a love letter of sorts for the former president, again highlighting his supposed accomplishments while neglecting to mention his failures or wrongly deflecting blame to others. President Trump never wavered in defense of our values, our families, our traditions, and our freedom, the website claims. However, Trump's actions and statements as president often did run counter to many Americans' families and values. He regularly engaged in racist rhetoric, including telling four congresswomen of color to go back to their own countries before criticizing his governing style. Meanwhile, he sowed division and hatred of undocumented immigrants and other marginalized groups. Trump's actions in his final month in office, too, were largely antithetical to the oft-observed peaceful transfer of power between administrations, as he engaged in pressure campaigns toward state officials throughout the U.S. to defy the will of voters after losing to now-President Joe Biden in last year's presidential race. He also sought to disrupt the certification process of Electoral College by encouraging his own vice president, Mike Pence, to reject the results, despite Pence not having the actual constitutional power to do so. Trump's new website, besides being a considered attempt to spin his record, appears to also be an attempt to reestablish his online presence. The site is part of Trump's efforts to reconstruct his digital presence after essentially being deplatformed after January Capitol insurrection, Axios Sarah Fisher noted. Trump has been banned from all of the major social media websites, including Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, following his inciting statements on those platforms after a mob of his loyalists attacked the U.S. Capitol in January.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back. I'm Saeed Pourreza in London. The campaign for Muhayyad Bashir, a young black man who died following police restraint in Wales, is gaining national momentum. His family and activists remain outraged that a young man grappling with a mental health crisis lost his life following contact with the very people who should have had his safety as their top priority. Richard Sudan has the details.
Went police remain firmly under the spotlight following the death of black man Muhayyad Bashir, who died on February the 17th following restraint by officers. Muhayyad was having a mental health crisis, needed help, and as a vulnerable human being did not pose a threat to anyone.
And the GP had advised that they contact the emergency services, which of course they did. And they contacted the emergency services by a 999 call and summoned what they thought was an ambulance. And very quickly, a number of police officers arrived and asked whether or not Muhayyad was violent. And he wasn't violent, he'd never been violent. And police officers entered his bedroom, and very quickly after entering his bedroom, Muhayyad fell silent.
My brother's room is right next to my parents' bedroom. And every morning when my mum wakes up, she keeps past my brother Muhayyad's bedroom and thinks that he's still around. But of course, when reality hits hard, he's not there anymore. So it's the same thing, you know, with my little brother. My little brother and Muhayyad were best friends.
And when you think about the learning that we've had in this country around the arrest of mentally ill people, there's no excuse for any police service in the world, in this country at least, to do anything but, you know, treat people in a humane and professional way. That wasn't the case with Bashir. He was manhandled, he had an injury to his leg, he subsequently died, and to think that took place in front of his parents who'd called for help is unimaginable.
With Muhayyad's family demanding answers, both the police and the Independent Office for Police Conduct are facing intense scrutiny.
Nobody called the police. Why was it necessary for when a man is having a mental health crisis for police to attend? And would have the outcome been the same had it been a white man or a white woman? I don't think so.
Confidence in the police, confidence in the IOPC in this country is at an all-time low amongst African and Caribbean heritage communities. And whether it's from here in Wales or whether it's in Northern Ireland or whether it's in England or Scotland, the overwhelming lived experience of black people is one of police oppression, and we don't trust the police. And it's no different here in the Welsh Valleys.
Our family history, that when we came into the UK, is because we seek asylum, because it wasn't safe back home. Again, just running away from fights, running away from death that's been surrounded, you know, in the country. And we assumed that being here in the UK, a democratic country, you know, that has laws and law and order, there's some sort of safety. But clearly that wasn't the case.
As the family of Muhayyad Bashir mourn the loss of their loved one, the campaign to publicise the case is accelerating nationwide.
The impact of the death of Muhayyad Bashir continues to be felt throughout the community. Like so many deaths in custody, the family demand full accountability from the police and ultimately action taken to secure justice. Richard Sudan, Gwent.
Meanwhile, the UK government's highly anticipated report on racism has concluded the country is not systematically racist and should be regarded as a model for other white-majority countries. Requested by Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the wake of last year's Black Lives Matter protests, it claims issues around race are becoming less significant. It also says there has been improvements in the country through the increase in diversity in elite professions and a shrinking ethnicity pay gap. The opposition Labour Party has blasted the report as disappointing, insisting structural racism remains in much of the country. Other critics have said the findings have done little to make sense and mend racial disparities in the country. Let's discuss those two stories with Wayman Bennett. He's a political analyst joining me from London. Good to have you with us. So two black men died within a month of each other. after they came in contact with the police. How bad is the issue of police brutality here in the UK?
Well, this whitewash report points to the fact that there's disproportionate contact with the police in black communities, and the government developed a hostile environment. In fact, it refers to the Windrush crisis, which was a consequence of the government. It refers to Prevent, which was another construct of the government, and yet it denies its racial element. It denies institutional racism. It says it's a matter of narrative and a matter of view. But when we look at Mohyed Bashir and his family and the loss of life, we think these are not just words. These lead to real actions on the street. The disproportionality of violence treated to families, and even the recourse to justice, is actually actively denied. This country at the moment says it needs more nuclear weapons in order to make sure that you have freedom of speech or freedom of activity or free from oppression. Yet when you look at it in practice, how it behaves itself, far from racism and Islamophobia and discrimination disappearing, unfortunately it's entrenched at the very highest levels of our government. And Boris Johnson himself referred to Muslim women looking like bank robbers and black people as grinning pickaninnies. This is hardly progressive language. Right. And it's something that came from our Prime Minister. So I believe this report's a whitewash. I believe to get justice, we have to keep raising these cases nationally, internationally, so that we can get past the hypocrisy and the denial of a government that could do something about it. It's not impossible to control the police. But we keep having reports that simply say there's nothing to identify. And if they don't identify, how can you deal with it? And I think that these things have to be challenged and changed.
But let's challenge it a little bit further. One of the findings of this report is that the UK should be regarded as a model for other white majority countries. Expand on the veracity of that statement and the truth of it, given these two cases of these two deaths at the hands of the police, and also the performance of the police over the past couple of weeks, the way they have been treating protesters who have been protesting the government's new policing bill.
Well, let's be clear. For the last 20 years, black people have been murdered at the hands of the police. Not a single police officer has been convicted of killing people, murdering people. And to be honest, as long as that's the case, I think that being in denial, our government's in collective denial about what the problem is. And actually, to congratulate itself, any progress that we've made is only because people have had to fight for it. The McPherson inquiry over 25 years ago said the police were institutionally racist and made a number of recommendations. Very few have been implemented. And if you look at what happened at the vigil for Sarah Everard, who the allegations that policemen may, there's an allegation that policemen may have murdered her, what you see is the police beat people up. And another report says they didn't beat people up. And I think that what we're facing is a kind of almost Orwellian denial of a government that, you know, has long had this practice. I'm sorry, it's 300 years old, has had this practice. It does wrong and then refuses to accept it. And there always are people that can be hired in order to present misinformation. The report itself says that you're disproportionately stopped by the police and that the police switch off the cameras at the point of arrest, as what happened to Mr. Bashir, and that this should be stopped. But then it goes on to say it's a matter of perception. It is not the perception of that family that their son has been murdered. It is not the perception of Mohammed Salim, the 83-year-old father who was murdered in Birmingham by a Nazi in April 8 years ago. This is not perception, this is reality. And right. It's disgusting that we could have such a cover-up take place, a whitewash report.
And the list goes on, doesn't it? Wayman Bennett in London, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
To other news now. Growing concerns across the globe as Myanmar descends into further protest and violence. Morteza Jaffer takes a closer look at the possible reasons why the military declared a state of emergency following the last general election.
Spiraling violence across Myanmar has raised fears of a bloody civil war after the military junta continues to face down opposition with increased violence. European leaders have voiced growing concerns over the deteriorating situation after hundreds of demonstrators were killed over the past few days.
The federal government strongly condemns the violent actions of the Myanmar security forces and the deadly use of weapons. This brutal violence unfortunately reached a new sad low at the weekend. There is no justification for using deadly force against the peaceful demonstrators.
We are extremely worried over the growing civilian casualties in Myanmar. It provokes our deep concern, and we are closely watching the situation in Myanmar. We have ties with Myanmar, but we do not welcome these scenes.
The European Union has threatened further sanctions after what it described as a day of horror. The United Nations accused Myanmar's junta of committing mass murder and has criticized the international community for not doing enough to stop the violence. The total death toll has surpassed 500, with civilians now fleeing into neighboring countries after reported airstrikes by the military. Senior Army General Min Aung Hlaing took reins of the country after disputing January's general election, which saw Aung San Suu Kyi's NLD party win by a landslide. She campaigned to reduce the political influence of the military and reduced the number of fixed military seats in the parliament. As results came in, many predicted a military coup. Some analysts believe personal ambition are a key determining factor.
This could all be down to the personal ambitions of General Min Aung Hlaing, who was due to retire in 6 months. He has used his position to ensure his family have lucrative business interests, which he won't be in a position to protect after retirement.
Protesters have pledged to continue defying the military, who have shown no intention in employing restraint. More deaths are predicted, with some claiming a civil war could break out. What the military want is also unclear. Do they want to protect their current political influence, or do they want to return the country to the complete military control of the last century?
Murtaza Jaffer with that report. Now, a UN report has accused France of killing 19 civilians by airstrike in Mali. They were among at least 22 people who died in that strike. In January, residents of a remote village in central Mali claimed French warplanes bombed a wedding celebration there, killing a number of civilians. That prompted an investigation by the UN mission in Mali. France, meantime, has refuted the findings, saying the strike targeted and killed terrorists. It's also denied any knowledge of the wedding in that village on that date. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says he's seen no serious efforts from the U.S. to revive the historic 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The president also said Washington has the ability to lift anti-Iran sanctions and return to the agreement within an hour, if it's so inclined. He pointed out that the U.S. President, Joe Biden, has emphasized diplomacy and admitted to the failure of his predecessor Donald Trump's maximum pressure policy. The fate of the JCPOA has been hanging in the balance since May 2018, when former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from it and imposed wide-ranging, harsh sanctions on the Islamic Republic.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
In this segment, and yet another attack on Press TV's social media accounts. This time, our access to YouTube, yet again. Let's bring in Robert Carter for more on that. And Robert, last week they took down our Facebook page before they restored it, and now this. What kind of excuse have they concocted this time?
Well, they hardly even gave us a reason, to be honest with you, Saeed. The takedown on YouTube, which is, of course, just one of numerous times in which YouTube has done so, they did it without warning. Obviously, the way YouTube works is it doesn't really allow you an opportunity to appeal those decisions, doesn't need to give you any reason. It just shuts you down, and that's that. Obviously, this is a continuation in a long line of attacks against Iranian media, essentially a clear attempt to gag the Iranian viewpoint. Of course, Press TV is a platform which promotes other stories, platforms, other groups, which usually Western mainstream media tend to ignore or are biased against. In
Maybe
particular,
expand on that a little bit, Robert. What kind of viewpoints are we talking about? How are we different that really has led to this censorship on the part of this tech giant?
Well, I would say, obviously, one of the key things is we're a critic of the Israeli regime. We platform Palestinians, we platform Muslims and Arabs. We're an Iranian channel. There's definitely a degree of Iran phobia, I believe, that's at play here. The fact is, these are US-based media or companies, giant companies. And obviously, right now, the US is pushing a maximum pressure campaign and a sanctions policy against the Islamic Republic of Iran. So, of course, they don't want the Iranian side of this dispute to get out. But one thing that I will give you a glimpse of now is not an Iranian perspective, but a Muslim Lebanese sister, Marwa Osman, who we know very well. She has also been censored, and she works for Press TV, but she's been censored herself on her own personal profiles on Facebook. So let's play that out now and see what she says.
Personally, the people who actually, me personally, I was censored. I'm never allowed to go live on Facebook anymore, because at one time I just took my phone. My village is right across the, right on the border with occupied Palestine. I wanted to show the world how U.S., how Israel is actually erecting an apartheid wall all the way on the border crossing between Palestine and Lebanon. I just showed that video. I was cut, and then was never allowed to go live on Facebook again.
Perhaps not the kind of stuff you would expect to see on the mainstream media, Robert.
Absolutely. So clearly this is bigger than just Press TV. This is a clear, probably state-backed effort by Western companies, particularly on social media platforms, to censor views which they don't like. And right now, of course, Muslim views are not liked in the West. The views of the Islamic Republic of Iran are not tolerated. Criticism of Israel, as I've said. And also the fact, remember, Press TV is anti-war, it's anti-racism. All these views tend to put Western regimes in a bad light. So obviously having Press TV up is not tolerated.
And then the question that we can also ask, Robert, is if we can be banned, if Press TV can be banned, who is going to be next?
Absolutely, and Press TV isn't alone in this censorship. There are many other channels, including Telesur, for example, the Venezuelan media, also Chinese media now, and Russian to some extent, are also under the spotlight. This, of course, has been condemned on social media. There is many supporters of our good work out there. Let's bring up some tweets now that I have on this subject. The first one I can bring up is from Richard Medhurst, who is a colleague of ours now at Press TV. He says that, you know, Press TV, CGTN, the Chinese state channel, Sputnik, and Telesur are doing something right when Ofcom, Britain's state-sponsored media regulator, takes them off the air and or Silicon Valley giants repeatedly ban their pages and accounts. Western governments can't stand foreign outlets informing their populace, especially in English. So I think that sums up the point very well, that we stand among many other foreign broadcasters that are not deemed to be friendly by the UK and the US that are being censored in this way. And then the next tweet I have, let's bring that up on screen now. Again, this is an interesting view from Zafar Mehdi, who says, media outlets like Press TV that challenge the US hegemony and the Israeli occupation of Palestine are constantly harassed. And let's remember that there is a lot of Palestinian and also Yemeni media too, which is being gagged, all by the same culprits, Facebook, YouTube, and to some degree Twitter as well.
Just like they say, we must be doing something right. To your second story now, a music video that sexualizes religious imagery and the release of limited edition of running shoes that reference the devil, Satan, and have 6 cubic centimeters of red fluid in the soles, said to contain a drop of human blood. What is the brouhaha over that?
Absolutely. So, warning, this will be a topic which will offend probably many of our moral viewers out there, our pious viewers. Satanic shoes have been released, would you believe, in the US? And as you rightly said, they are deeply blasphemous, deeply offensive to Christians, and they're basically promoting Satanism, would you believe? So, if Western decadence hadn't already reached a particularly poor state, then this is taking it to a whole new level. Yes, human blood is allegedly in the soles of the shoes, as you can see there on the screen, Luke 10:18. That's a reference to a Bible verse has been placed on the shoe of this trainer, which of course Christianity, which originated from the Middle East, putting something holy like a scripture on a shoe is deeply offensive in traditional Christian, Islamic, or any Abrahamic religion's viewpoint.
Is the reference to Satan or the fallen angel falling from the sky?
Yes, absolutely. So every aspect of this sickening shoe is basically aimed at offending Christians to the maximum possible way, and it really is beggar's belief. It makes me proud, actually. I have to say that Muslims, like you see at Batley Grammar School, come out in protest whenever there are attempts made to insult or mock religions which billions of people around the world adhere to. And what I think is a real shame is that Christianity has reached such a stage of failure and collapse that it's allowing something like this to take place without much direct protest.
Well, let's see what folks have been saying about this online.
There should be a TikTok reaction. Let's see if we can bring that up now.
Rapper Space, who's endorsing it? There's evil all over it. Evil isn't hiding anymore. It's in plain sight. It's time for Christians to step up. I will never support Nike again.
Well, Nike really shouldn't be happy right now about what's happening, probably boycotting of the brand by a lot of people.
Yes, absolutely. There is a massive Christian backlash online which is being discussed, but ultimately we see a lack of action on the ground, particularly in the US where the shoe is based. There are further online social media reactions. Perhaps I could bring that on screen. We have a tweet from Anna who says, "May every single one of you realize how unconditional and pure God, his love for you really is. Turn away from these sins and start doing research into religion. Please, I'll pray for you all."
And there Robert, is also another we're going to have to leave it at that for now because we're fresh out of time. Those stories, Robert, thank you very much. And goodbye.
Canada likes to see itself as a benign global actor, but its extensive history of military intervention tells a different story. A $70 billion upgrade of the Canadian Navy, now carried out by Justin Trudeau, will strengthen its capacity for military action as a U.S. sidekick in world affairs, says Yves Engler-Ryder in an article titled, "The Canadian Government Talks About Peace, But It's Investing in War." Stay tuned, please, for the details. Canada has marketed itself for many years as a peacekeeping nation and benevolent international actor, but this appearance is only plausible if one's point of comparison lies directly south of the border. The Canadian state has long had a privileged relationship with the United States and Britain, the two leading empires of the last two centuries. In reality, its appearance as a tender-hearted broker in international affairs is a public relations sleight of hand. Ottawa has deployed its relatively sophisticated military in action far more often than most people recognize. Canada is now preparing to equip its navy with new frigates at an estimated cost of $70 billion, $100 billion over their life cycle. As part of the largest single outlay of public money in Canadian history, the 15 vessels will be kitted out with a mixture of offensive and defensive weapons, in a mix never seen before any surface combatant. Thus far, this expenditure has not elicited any paramilitary opposition. The 7,800 metric ton vessels have space for a helicopter and remotely piloted systems. The frigates have electronic warfare capabilities, torpedo tubes, and various high-powered guns. They will also possess naval strike missile harpoons that can fire missiles from a distance of 185 kilometers. Most controversially, the surface combatant looks set to be equipped with Tomahawk cruise missiles capable of striking land targets up to 1,700 kilometers away. The U.S.-based firm Raytheon has only ever exported these Tomahawk missiles to the U.K. If the Royal Canadian Navy acquires them, it will be the only navy besides the United States to deploy.